Okay, so we won't chant again, but now we're starting with new batteries. Good morning. I want to talk about roxas, or rakusus, as a friend of mine says. A rakusu is the small version of Buddha's robe. Liam has one on, Carol has one on, and Janet has one on. And they sold them. And I'll talk about it. But I just want to say something first about the importance of ritual, and one of the things that sowing a rakusu and receiving the precepts at the end of that process is a ritual. Yesterday morning, it just was really brought home to me in a way I hadn't exactly thought of before. Yesterday morning at the Berkeley Zen Center, I made a presentation about Sesshin guidelines or Sesshin admonitions. Sesshin is when you sit all day or longer. And the Berkeley one had, they don't know exactly why, but over the years it had gotten much more skewed towards kind of the business, like, you know, where you should park and what to do about keys and stuff like that, and less towards practice in the admonitions. They call them guidelines. Being Berkeley, of course, they're guidelines. They have they have coordinators and facilitators and guidelines, you know, and other people have chairs of committees and admonitions. But at any rate, so that's what we were talking about, and I offered some that were largely, I was asked to do this, that were largely based on San Francisco Zen Center and on what we do here. And it became clear that these had been the Berkeley guidelines, or a lot of it had, but they had just sort of disappeared over the years. And also that it had changed a lot from Sesshin director to Sesshin director, I think. You know, people sometimes take over a job and they need to change everything. But one of the things I found for myself was that there's certain language that I think speaks to us. When it's kind of poetic language, that has something to do with it. But also just hearing the same thing time after time after time, I have a kind of a, I suppose it's a Pavlovian reaction, but it's a useful one. In other words, when I hear be silent and still, follow the schedule completely, my body just goes, oh, sinks into it. And there's a kind of feeling of willingness or acceptance or something. Oh, I'm going to do this now. It's here. Yes. Something. But it isn't something. I don't think about that. And I just realize when I hear those two sentences, I do have a body response to it. And I think it's partly because it is nice, it's kind of poetic language. Be silent and still is simple. But I think it's more about just the repetition than that this means we're going into Sesshin, we're going into something deeper, we're going to gather the mind. I am committing to the still place, something like that, I don't know. But there's just, just saying it in the meeting yesterday, my body went, oh, oh, that's interesting. It's really powerful. It's a little creepy. Think about a hamburger. Does your mouth salivate? You know? Or whatever does it for you, I guess. Cream cheese. Cheesecake. I'm a grease and salt person, so garlic fries sounds much more attractive to me than cheesecake. Anyway, It is interesting how powerful these things are. And Jukai or sewing a raksu has elements of that. I think that's part of why we sew our own. And there are rituals like this. There's conditioning like this, if you will, that I think is useful, as long as you keep your eyes open. Right? You don't just blindly jump into something and because somebody said, oh, this is a good idea. That doesn't make it a good idea. Or if somebody says, I'm going to tell you the truth, that doesn't make it true. Right? So it's not about being foolishly faithful or something like that. The reason I want to talk about raksus is because there are some people in the Sangha that are sewing or are going to sew soon and going to start. So it's a good time, if you're interested, it's a good time to ask about it, because it's nice to do it with other people and to have a gang, so that when you actually take the precepts, you have some company. Carol was a hybrid, but it worked out. She sewed with Lynn, who was sewing a replacement raksu with Norman, and Trish, who was sewing her first raksu with Darlene, but we all actually sewed together, and we were also working on my very fancy green okesa. So she had a lot of company, and then at the time, Abby Bass renewed her vows and got a new lineage paper. So it all worked out. But that's part of why now, and also because I need to talk about it every so often to remind myself, to remind those of us who have raksus, and to encourage people who might consider it. So I just think I should talk about it every couple of years. And if you notice that it's been a long time, feel free to say, you haven't given... It's probably going to become... Now I put it in the computer. It's going to become the raksu lecture. I hope not. So it's not... There's not any set rule about who might consider sewing a raksu. I'd say in very rough terms, somebody who's been practicing for at least a couple of years, maybe longer, has some regularity in their practice, has an established sitting practice, and depending on their circumstances, that they be sitting, like one day sittings and so on. I told Nan she had the over 80 exception. But everybody is different, and some people it makes sense to consider it after 2 years, and some people more like 15. I don't know. It's entirely up to you. It's a personal commitment, and you have to want to do it. You have to want to jump in that way. It's more a commitment to getting in there and wrestling with the precepts than it is a commitment to a particular teacher. It has that aspect of a commitment to a teacher, but it's not, priest ordination is definitely commitment to work with a teacher, but Jukai is a little less so. It has that, but it's like, I don't know, 25% as opposed to 75%, I don't know. Because priest practice is also about a bunch of other things too. So if it's ever just about the teacher, I think that's a problem. A friend of mine was talking about being ordained and took me aside once at Tassajara to tell me that, and then and said, no. And I said, That's not good, because if you're going to be ordained, it ought to be for the Dharma, not for a person. And it was too much of that kind of cheerleading. Not that you shouldn't be devoted to your teacher, you shouldn't be willing to wrestle with your teacher too, but it isn't just about, it's about the Dharma and the teacher, what the teacher represents. And I think part of the problem is it's too much about the teacher, and then when the teacher makes a mistake and turns out not to be perfect, as I mean, I know this is a shock to you. None of us are. You know, then what? Sometimes it's we want safety from the teacher. We want perfection, therefore it's safe. Well, it's not safe. Not in that way. Nobody is safe in that way. As I'm sure you know, from being in relationships with others, we hurt each other. We screw up. We say intemperate things. We do things. And the relationship is you say, ow, that hurt, or whatever. And you also look at, you know, am I being too reactive because of my own ancient tangled karma, yada, yada. So I don't want to be, I'm just saying this to put a little context that it's not about giving over to somebody. It's about deepening your relationship with the precepts and with the teacher. And I come back and talk about Jukai a little bit, but the story is that the pattern on Araksu is a pattern of rice paddies. And it's the same on these larger versions of Buddha's robe that Carol and I have on. These are called okesas. This is an okesa. And it's a very similar, it's pretty much the same pattern. It just has, instead of five rows, it's got these two who both have seven rows. And that fancy green one I have has nine rows and they're lined. That's why, part of why it took so long to sew. At any rate, the story is that one of Buddha's supporters, one of the various feudal lords that he worked with, had seen a monk in the distance and stopped his carriage and gotten down and bowed down to this monk, only to find that this monk was not a follower of the Buddha. And he wanted to have some way of knowing whether a monk that he saw on the road was a follower of the Buddha or not. So he asked Buddha if he might design, if they, you know, the monks could come up with something distinctive to wear that would show that they were followers of the Buddha. So the Buddha was walking on the road one day, and you understand that the road in those days would have been a path, right? Wide enough for a chariot maybe. At any rate, he was walking along through rice fields. And he looked at the pattern, you know, they have little levees going around them. And they, because they flood them, right? So there's this little raised paths. And he looked and he said, that's a nice pattern. Do you think you could come up with something like that? And Ananda said, yes. And this is the result. So that's the story. I don't know if it's true or not, but I like it. It's a nice story. And you can look at various ones afterwards if you want. Just as an aside, there are two different, there are two different schools of Raksu sewing. One is you use really light colored thread so you can see what you're doing, or you use dark colored thread so nobody can see your mistake. I'm of a light colored thread school myself because I like to be able to see what I'm doing, and in the end they all look beautiful. There's a man whom you don't know and you probably won't know, Bubba, at Berkeley Zen Center, who never sewed before and is not a sewer and whatever, he's a contractor. And his sewing is really, forgive me, bad. I mean, he doesn't sew well, and the stitches are, every stitch is different and some of them are really big. You are not in his league. Don't look at me like that. You are not in his league. And And it's really, you know, if you look at the individual stitches or something, you might say, oh, my. But it's beautiful. It's beautiful because his heart is there. So we, perhaps in that process, we give them meaning as we sew them. And that is part of why we sew our own. You can buy Roxu. If you ever see me wearing a navy blue one with a circle on it, white circle. I think it's plastic. I don't think it's ivory, but at any rate, a white circle. That one was given to me by the Soto Zen headquarters in Japan, and that's a store-bought Roxu. But years ago, there was kind of a movement in Japan to start going back to doing it the way Dogen did it. Dogen is a Japanese founder of our school. That's Dogen right there. 1200 to 1253. There was this movement, and Katagiri Roshi was very involved and came out of that tradition. And then he came here, and I guess he started talking about it, and eventually Suzuki Roshi decided that that would be good for the people at San Francisco Zen Center, and so they invited, the main person that they invited was a woman named Joshin-san, and she's the person that taught Blanche Hartman how to sew. And Blanche says she was a terrible seamstress. Blanche was so bad that the second semester of home ec sewing, Blanche was in her 80s, right? So then the girls all took home ec and the boys all took shop, right? So she's in home ec sewing. In the first semester, they made, I don't know, pot holders and aprons or something. The second semester, they were supposed to make suits. And the teacher looked at her and said, you know, the fabric is really expensive. Why don't you refinish the sewing machines this semester? So that's what Blanche did. And she wasn't very good at it, and also I think she resisted it. I think she did take shop, which would have been amazing then. And she didn't take typing, which she now regrets, but at the time that was kind of a protest. The girls took typing. Anyway. She learned how to sew because she wanted to work with a woman teacher. And that was what was on offer. So she learned. And also in the process, she learned that sewing a Roxu is probably more of an engineering event than it is a sewing event. And she's a good engineer. And what a sewing teacher does a lot is fix little messes. When you cut the thread too short, and now what do you do? That kind of thing, or you made a knot in the thread in the middle of something, now what do? So, in our lineage, we sew our own roxas. And as I started with talking about ritual, that, and with each stitch, you take refuge in Buddha. Namu, namu im kie, through butsu as you come up and pull the thread tight. Namu Kiye Butsu, I take refuge in Buddha. I align myself with Buddha with every stitch. And every so often, just like in Zazen, you forget and you start talking. And then you remember. I'll tell you another story, which is one time I was the head of the meditation hall at City Center. I was the Eno. And it was during Sesshin, and there was a work period, and some people were sewing with Blanche during the work period because they had roxas that needed to be finished up. There was a deadline or something, so they were sewing. So there were, I don't know how many people were in the sewing room, 6 or 8 people were in there with Blanche during the work period, and I needed to ask her something about some ceremony the next day or something, I don't know, anyway. I went over to the sewing room, and I walked in the door of the sewing room, took off my shoes, and turned towards the actual sewing part of it, and I realized it was just and I just stood there for a minute, and she turned and she Blanche saw me, and she said, "Busted." So it's our intention, just as with us, and then we forget, and then we come back to it. Namu kiye butsu. And that intentionality, every stitch. And you can sew, people even sew at home on their own in between classes. Namu kiye butsu. We bow in before we start. Because it is a ritual event. It is, in some way, with each stitch, deepening our practice, deepening our relationship with the precept. It's another one of those times when you enact your intention with your body. So it isn't a... You're saying Namu Kiye Butsu, but the deepening of intention is just a body thing that's happening. Not just... It is a body thing that's happening. So at the end of the process, then there's a Jukai ceremony. At Berkeley, they're usually in June, and San Francisco Zen Center, I'm not sure how they do it. They have them throughout the year. Every so often there's a Jukai. There are a lot of teachers there now, and there are a lot of people sewing Roksu, so they have a lot of Jukais. For us, it's been so far that we just, when the crop is ready, then we harvest. And, you know, it's nice if it could happen, you know, before the practice period or during the practice period or something, but it doesn't really matter. Jukai means, kai is precepts. Jukai means giving and receiving precepts. It's got this notion of circularity. I give you the precepts. But you give me the precepts, and you give us the precepts. When somebody takes the precepts, it deepens everybody's practice. Everybody who is there can feel it. And those who have already sown Roksus can particularly feel it. Like it reminds you of what you did. And there is that maybe Pavlovian response of just sinking into it. And I like to have everyone, you sew the Roksu, and you know the back is silk, but it's blank at that time when you sew it. And then you sew it, and you give it to the teacher, and who then writes on it, and the ceremony gives it back to you. So there's a circularity to that as well. But when I give the precepts, I feel that I receive the precepts also. It deepens my practice. So it's giving and receiving the precepts. You do, at the time, receive a new name. And it's usually, we, in our lineage, often, I think traditionally it's actually you just get one name, but we do two names. So the first name reflects kind of how the teacher sees you now. And the second name is what the teacher sees that you need to, I'm being rough about, you need to work on. Or that, you know, the teacher sees the potential in you. But that maybe you don't see so well, or you could develop more or something. So my second name is Total Joy. You also receive a lineage paper, and it's got a bloodline, and it starts up at the top. It's about like this. I don't know, what is that? Two and a half feet long, something like that. And up at the top is Buddha, and then it's got this red line that goes, and it's got all the ancestors down through Sojin, Mel Weitzman, my teacher, and me, and then your name. And then that red line goes all the way back up to Buddha. So again, it's a circle. So you receive a new name and a Roksu with your name on it, and usually some quote or some saying, or perhaps a poem by William Carlos Williams, you never know. Something on it. And then you have the rest of your life to figure out what in the world you did. And I hope that if you do it, that it is a question for the rest of your life. If ever you think you have it figured out, you're in trouble. It does not mean that you're already perfect. So sorry. Even priest ordination, even Dharma transmission doesn't mean that. So sorry. I've had people say, I cannot take the precepts because I eat meat. I cannot take the precepts because you fill in the blank. That's not an excuse. You know, you can't. It's about getting in there and working with them. It's not about being perfect. Or sometimes people are like, I haven't read all of Dogen, or I don't know all the items in the Eightfold Path, or, you know, so that kind of thing. It's good to know all the items in the Eightfold Path, though I'm not sure I know them. Could I recite them all? I'm not sure. But at any rate, that's not in the middle. In the middle is, what's your relationship with the precepts? Are you willing to turn towards the precepts? And I include, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. I include avoid all evil, do all good, save all beings. What in the world do those things mean? May those be live questions for you. Another one is, I can't sew. It's common. You know, a lot of people nowadays can't sew. When I was a kid, girls at any rate, learned how to at least do a hem and sew on a button. And I learned how to sew and use a sewing machine. But nowadays, I don't think that's common. I don't know exactly what people do if they get a pair of slacks or pants or something and they're too long. I know what I do, which is that I take them to the cleaners and get them hemmed. Which, it isn't that expensive. I have an excuse. I think I like giving them work, which is true, but, I have too many pairs of pants that I never wore because I never got around to hemming them. So I thought, this is kind of stupid. And my sewing machine sits gathering dust. At any rate, there are a lot of people that never even sewed on a button. But again, it's not about sewing. I mean, you do have to learn how to do this kind of sewing, but it's not about fine needlework. It's about putting your heart into it. And if you need to, you can take stitches out, but we try not to take too many stitches out. Because again, this reflects you. It's like being a Doan or being the Kokyo, leading the chanting. Those are your bells. That's your voice right now. And so here, what is it right now? Sometimes you're sounding the bells and that day you're relaxed and whatever, you have a good relationship with the bell that day and they just sound beautiful. And then another day you're tense or whatever it might be and they just sound harsh and this. Or you're the Kokyo and your voice cracks. Or you forget to take a breath where you need to and you run out of breath somewhere in the middle. So, that's you being Kokyo that day. So that's you sewing that day. So you want to do it really wholeheartedly, but it's not going to be perfect. I don't even remember who sewed on this one I'm wearing right now, so I don't know that it, and I know I did not make the one, the Roxy that I have out today. But you could look at that Roxy, which is sewed by a woman named Kathy Wilden, who was a sewing teacher in Monterey and very, very good. And if you glance at it, it probably looks perfect. But if you look again, it's not. You know, the stitches aren't, like precisely 1/16th of an inch apart every time or whatever it might be. Are they always dots or they sometimes sort of creep up into lines? It's a beautiful roxu. So it's not about some kind of perfection. And as I said, it's about deepening your relationship with the precepts. There's a wonderful book called Waking Up to What You Do by Diane Rossetto, and she talks about working with the precepts as I take up the practice of, so that you focus on a precept, like not killing, say, I take up the practice of not killing. And then you come to understand that for yourself and your own body and mind. What does it mean for you to not kill? Is it about not eating meat? Is it about not slapping a mosquito when it bites you? Is it about not eating factory farm-raised meat? Is it about not squelching people's spirits? All of the above. What is it for you? And Trish talks about this, so I think I can talk about it. Her mother is in her mid-90s and has been losing her memory and so on for about the last 5 years or so. And earlier, Trish had a really hard time with it. And she would argue with her mother about what day of the week it was. And she would yell at her mother when her mother asked the same question over and over. And so Trish, working with the precepts, decided, I take up the practice of not lying. I take up the practice of telling the truth. And then she worked with, what does it mean to tell the truth? I mean, the fact that it's Wednesday rather than Thursday, is that what's true in that situation? No. That there's a larger truth, which is that your mother is having a hard time with that. I mean, her mother wasn't upset. And so Trish started arguing with her, then she'd get upset. So what's the truth there? And the truth maybe is, even that is a hard one for most of us. When that shift happens, as it often does in the parent-child relationship, and you have to become your parent's parent because they are becoming more and more childlike, that's painful. And a lot of us have a hard time, and we argue, we resent it. You're supposed to be my mommy, and I'm not the mommy, and you're supposed to take care of me. I mean, that's on the primal level, that's how we feel, and then we have to notice it, feel it, let it go. You know, is there a movie about on Golden Pond about that? Is that the movie about that with Henry Fonda and Jane Fonda? I think. And kind of lets her have it. That's how it is, kiddo. At any rate, that's the larger truth. So that's where Trish had needed to work with being honest with herself about what was going on with her, so she stopped acting it out with her poor mother. And that's just how it is. So that's working deeply with that precept. But we each have our own relationships with the precept. What is it for you? So I take up the practice of is a useful thing. Or as I said, I mentioned before, having these questions. Well, what is it to take refuge in Buddha? What is Buddha anyway? Is it some guy? Is it some statue? Is it truth, beauty? Is it light? Is it Buddha nature? This whatever it is? This-ing? Is-ing? Is that it? Is it something I can hold on to? Well, how can I, refuge means like to return home. How can I return home to nothing? Or return home to no thing even. What's that? I don't know. So these become questions, and usually certain things kind of speak to you, and then that becomes your focus. You don't necessarily go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 10. You know, it's something calls to you, and then that becomes an entrance point. I think that sowing raksu also represents something shifting in one's practice, that it becomes a little more about, oh, I don't know, the sangha or something like that. less about one's own individual practice, maybe. It's always both. It better be both. Because you've got to take responsibility for this one. But it shifts. And it shifts again in priest ordination. Sojin once said, he was asked about why he became a priest or what it meant to him. And he asked Katagiri and he asked Suzuki Roshi, and they both said, I don't know. But he thought about it, and he came. This was at Tassajara, and my friend Cassandra was visiting, and she mentioned it yesterday, and I had it's something that I still think about, and I didn't know that she still thought about it too. She remembered. So he said, you know, I'm going to think about that. And then the next time there was a lecture or something in public, he said, you know, I've been thinking about it, and I realized that for me, it's that the robe represents taking care of something outside of myself or other than myself. It was an opportunity to care for something other than me. And he was talking about an okesa, but it applies equally to a raksu. So if you are interested, then please talk to me about it. It's something that we come to together, really, and it's not automatic, but it's also something to talk about. It's nothing shameful to talk about it. And when I have big issues about commitment, or more than I did in terms of this practice, and I was thinking about sewing a raksu, but I was afraid to ask because I was afraid Mel would ask me why, and I could not articulate why, because it was too close to my heart, and I could not look at it, and I sure as hell wasn't going to talk about it. So I went to him finally and I said, I'm thinking about sewing a raksu, or asking you about sewing a raksu, but I'm afraid you'll ask me why. And he said, I won't ask you why. I said, oh, okay, can I sew a raksu? He said, yeah, how? And I still didn't really let myself. I did it, and it was not easy. I found myself kind of not doing it, and I had to go down to Tassajara to find Mama Blanche and kind of set myself that I'd sew every afternoon to finally finish it. And it still didn't. I didn't really let it in, and then. The day of, I was sitting with my Jukai gang, and for all of us, I think, it was all of a sudden, it hit us. Oh, this is a big deal. What? What? That was very powerful. One of the priests at Berkeley had told us about it, that he felt like he got hit over the head with a board. And then I had thought, when he said that, I thought, oh, all right, give me a break. But then that afternoon, waiting to go in for the ceremony, that would do as a description. So you have the rest of your life to figure out what it is that you've done, and to figure out what your name means. What was that person trying to tell me? And you can go ask, but you're probably not going to get very much of an answer. Oh, were you ready? Because it's a koan for you. So, if you're interested, please see me. Do you have any questions at this point? Or comments? Those of you who have done it. Did you get hit over the head with a board?
Very helpful and enjoyable also. It was very moving. Yeah. Sewing with a group. I sewed in Berkeley with 6 or 8 people. It's a very nice process. In respect, making that more of a commitment has been really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't say it in those terms exactly, but it helps us. And it's a support. The process itself and having a Roxu is a support to one's practice and a support to other people's practice. And it doesn't mean that somebody has a Roxu doesn't mean that they're like better than other people or something like that. And there are people that never saw a Roxu. But at any rate, it isn't a hierarchical event.
I would be like the contractor. Did he use dark thread or light thread?
Light thread. Because otherwise, I don't think I would. I haven't been directly involved in his. I was there when he took the precepts, but I wasn't involved with the sewing or anything. But I've seen his raksu, and I wouldn't have noticed it if it had been dark thread. I could see it in my mind's eye. They're all beautiful.
Going back to the origination of the pattern, I had read or heard sometime long ago that the reason that it was the small squares was because Buddhists told the Lord that he would be wasteful to have the robes with all that cloth, but he would do it using scraps of material that they found, and so his followers were supposed to go and find old material and cut it up into squares.
Well, that's true for all of those robes, priest robes and roksus, that they're traditionally supposed to be made with what's called pamsala, which is cast off fabric that might have been used to wrap a body, or that a woman used during her period, or that was just used for trash, and then you wash it really well, and then you kind of dye it this, you know how like a Theravadan monks, that sort of earth tone, that yellowish brown. I don't know if you ever, as a kid, you ever melt a whole bunch of crayons together? Unless you use a lot of black, that's about the color it comes out. So there, it is supposed to be. That's why we call them patch-robed monks. So we've gotten away from that. But I know people, Tia has a robe like that.
Does she?
That's a woman at City Center. So she has a robe that she made out of just scraps of fabric. So it's black, but it's different colors of black and different kinds of fabric. So there's, you know, these pieces are squares and rectangles. But what we do is we have a piece of fabric, and then you have a perfectly good piece of fabric, and you cut it up, and you sew it back together in this kind of complicated way. Anyway.
Okay. Beings are numbers.